Welcome, everyone, to the Bituation Room on a Frantastic Friday. Again, a second course, maybe even a third course of the Bituation Room for your week, rounding out this Friday, reframing myself in the camera, in the image, in the I have words. I'll find them later. What a week. Oh, boy. We have obviously gone through what has been happening on campuses, the repression that students have been facing, the misinformation. We had a hearty bitch sesh with Max from Unfuck the Republic or Unfucking the Republic and comedian Anthony Atamanik about real versus imagined and manufactured anti-Semitism, as well as, you know, staring down the barrel of full-blown fascism. We might be in sort of fascism light now. And so I felt like it was time to round out the week with some throwbacks, given that this is some of the most heroic anti-war organizing that we've seen on college campuses since 2003, since the Iraq War, mass movements maybe since Occupy Wall Street, and then maybe the first time we've seen this amount of campus activism specifically around the issue of Gaza and Palestinians and the U.S.'s complicity in it. I mean, little 2003-year-old me or 18-year-old me would have never imagined that divestment could have become so mainstreamed among students and how... what that means. I mean, it means really good things, despite this being a uniquely scary time. And for this conversation, I have to bring in a personal mentor of mine who I met while he was on his book tour for the book that everyone should be reading called Revolution in the Air, 60s Radicals Turned to Lenin, Che, and Mao, which was really taking stock of the momentum in the 60s, that revolutionary spirit, and what happened to it, the incredible things about it, the pitfalls. And as a young, you know, radical myself, I was so curious about how previous movements had tried, failed, what lessons they'd learned. And he is also part of the editorial collective of Convergence magazine, which consistently puts out, again, movement strategy, analysis, and he's a writer. He's got a latest piece called, or I don't know if it's latest, but What We Can Learn from Aaron Bushnell's Self-Immolation, the man, the myth, the legend, Max Elbaum. Max, so glad to have you here. I'm actually glad to have you here. I'm not just saying that. I'm not just mustering the excitement because you're a friend, you're a mentor, you're a comrade. Welcome.
Thank you. Yes, we met at another time that was both inspiring and agonizing, and here we are again, not in exactly the same way. What do they say? History doesn't repeat, but sometimes it rhymes, and this, this is one of those rhymes.
It is one of those rhymes, and let me just, like, I think when we met, and this is, and I think we're looking back at 2003, 2005 and the anti-war movement then very closely in the ways that we are being, we didn't have the word then, but we're being very gaslit by both the political elites, you know, in a bipartisan consensus, as well as the media. But I think something that I asked you then, Max, and I'll ask it to you again, is that while history might rhyme, you'd figure at some point we would learn. You know, like, when does the learning happen? When does the military industrial complex, when does the Democratic Party, when does the learning, when does the media actually catch on to the fact that, hey, they've been wrong in all of these other instances before? And why can't they actually get on the right side of history? And the way I see it framed is like, well, look, the media and the elites, they're always on the wrong side of history. Look at the civil rights movement. Look at the anti-Vietnam War protest movement. And look at the 2003 Iraq War, anti-Iraq War movement. And it doesn't actually comfort me, Max, because it makes me more cynical and upset because I'm thinking, I understand that we're on the right side of history and they're not, but motherfuck. I mean, how long can we afford for them not to actually get on the right side of history? That's how I want to open this and put it to you.
Well, people have learned, but people learn different lessons depending on their class and political interests. The part of the world that we live in, the political world that we live in, is standing on the shoulders of what happened before. The students, the inspiring students that are out there are way ahead of where we were in the 1960s and where we were when we, you and I met in the early 2000s, politically. And there's a lot of lessons that they've learned consciously or semi-consciously that they're actually practicing right now. Now, the other side, they've learned some things too. They haven't learned the things we want them to learn, but we're in the middle, we're fighting the latest incarnation of the people we fought in 1963, 1964, 1965. There's a direct line from the people who were beating up those students who were nonviolently sitting in at Woolworth counters for civil rights, or who beat up the initial anti-war protesters in 1965 and 66, to the people who are attacking encampments today, and to the people who are ordering the police to attack the encampments today. So the other side has learned some lessons. They're not the ones we want, but they learn the lessons that they think will keep them in power or gain more power for their agenda. Learned a different set of lessons. So history doesn't vindicate anybody. The people who write the history books, the winners write the history.
Right.
And, for the last 15 years, we won the ideological battle about civil rights. People won't admit they were opposed to civil rights, or if they do that, well, that was then. They don't want to study Black history because, or American history, because they'd have to admit that their forerunners were opposed to what now we're all sanctifying as, the civil rights movement was glorious.
And one of those people was Joe Biden.
One of those people is Joe Biden.
That's how long he's been in politics. I mean, it really doesn't have to do with age, because you're a testament to the fact that you can be an old radical. Sorry, not quite as old as Biden, but you can be. And I did want to talk about what I think you're right, that the students are standing on the shoulders of all of these movements that have come before. And yet, the military industrial complex, capitalism, the political, the duopoly feels more frenetic, almost feels more frenetic than ever. Like, it feels like they know their days are numbered. And that's why the overreaction is even more extreme. That's one way to look at it. But I'm curious, do you feel like this is more extreme? Is it because it is about Israel and it has this sort of shroud of fake liberalism around, supposedly standing up for Jewish Americans or Jews around the world? Or is it actually, do you think it is a marked, difference than some of the repression we've seen earlier? I'm curious about your thoughts on how you compare.
Yeah, I think it is more repressive. I think the students today face more difficulties in a number of ways, and I think it's for a combination of reasons. Mm. One reason is that U.S. hegemony in the world and the stability of the capitalist system led by the United States is in decline compared to where it was in the 60s or in the 80s. It's still far from as fragile as many of us would like to think, but it's definitely in decline, and that leads to one thing. And then, yes, the situation, there is a mass base of support for Israel, and the way the charge of anti-Semitism has been weaponized. There's a kind of lobby for that project that's built on the whole mythology of the State of Israel and the period in which Zionism was overwhelmingly hegemonic, not just within the Jewish community, but within American politics generally. And for that to be through, I mean, you get in more trouble talking about creating a Palestinian state or giving Palestine back to the Palestinian people than you get into if you say give California California and Texas back to Mexico.
Right, of course.
This is, you know, and, you know, the other dynamic of that is there's nothing more dangerous than people who conceive of themselves as victims who are actually in positions of power and have guns. And that's one of the reasons for the viciousness of the MAGA movement and of the Israeli leadership, and most unfortunately a big chunk of the Israeli Jewish population, which is the sense that they are victims in the United States, the sense that white Christian men are the victims of today's culture. Right. And the sense, the trauma, the Holocaust, that has led one strand within Judaism to see itself as the eternal victim. Scratch a Gentile and you have an anti-Semite. And that kind of thinking justifies, once you think that way, you're justified in doing anything. And I do think that's different from where we were in the 1960s. And it's different in a different way from where we were in the period of the war on terror and the invasion of Iraq that you and I were, the time when you and I connected.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's go back. Let's talk about, you know, you as a student anti-war organizer during, you know, the anti-Vietnam movement. I think that one of the, I mean, we could talk about, you know, last time you came on, we talked about LBJ and we talked about sort of electoral politics and what this could all be leading toward. You also have, you know, openly talked about needing an alternative to Biden. I think months later, that's could be a little bit different. But in terms of being a student and seeing at the time, seeing peers, people you knew, potentially coming home in body bags by the thousands, American soldiers coming back from Vietnam. Also, it was one of the first wars, right, to be fully broadcast. So seeing the devastation and the carnage on television every single night, and the war machine, for lack of a better term, you know, the empire, the United States military, learned their lesson, which was, we're not going to broadcast that stuff anymore. And so I think during the first and, of course, the second Gulf Wars, the war in Iraq, we saw an incredibly sanitized version of this that was only broke through with, you know, when we saw the Abu Ghraib photos, you know, or when you saw the sort of maybe the private contractors in Fallujah who were killed, right? Or, you know, Chelsea Manning's leaks and WikiLeaks and seeing civilians and journalists just killed from the sky. Now we are seeing, and I'm curious what you think, social media has put us back in that Vietnam War era where every day you are seeing the carnage, the devastation. No, it's not American soldiers and your friends in body bags, but it's children. It is doctors. It is mass graves. That is so much trauma that your generation experienced. Can you just talk about what you all went through and then how you see that mirrored today?
Yeah, I mean, you described the trauma of my generation very well. I mean, the violence was everywhere, on television every night. The violence in Vietnam, the fact that if we didn't go to Vietnam ourselves, we all knew people from our high school classes and so on who were there and didn't come back or came back in a body bag or with what today is called PTSD. That was traumatic. Some of the differences from today. One of the main differences, the demographics in the United States, there were not, I didn't meet a Vietnamese person until 1970 or 71. There was not a large number of Vietnamese in the United States. So the people that we saw who might, we saw them die on television, and we knew people who were in the American Army who might get killed. But we didn't have a personal and direct connection until very late in the war with Vietnamese themselves. That's changed, because the population of Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims in the United States has changed. The demographics on most college campuses are tremendously different than they were in the 1960s. And most students now, if they're not Palestinian, they know someone who's Palestinian, or they know somebody who's got a family there. So it's not just seeing it on social media, although that's an important part of it. It's also having a personal connection, having a personal connection. And the dehumanization doesn't work as well with that population. You know, during my time, I watched on television when General William Westmoreland, who was the head of U.S. troops in Vietnam, said Orientals don't value human life the way that we do. Vietnamese were called gooks. I mean, every racist colonial war tries to dehumanize the population that it's butchering. But the dehumanization of Palestinians, people in Gaza, doesn't take with the new generation. Where it takes is a lot of older people who are still living in that bubble that Israel is a, you know, democratic, equal country in a, quote, bad neighborhood, always threatened by these barbarians who are, you know, who are out to Jews and kick it, you know, destroy a Jewish supremacist state, but want to actually kill and eliminate or deport every person who's Jewish. That kind of dehumanization was possible. It took a lot of hold in the United States in the late 60s, 70s, 80s, into the war on terror and what we saw of the dehumanization of the Islamophobia. But people who've grown up in the period since then, people who are students now, Israel, their experience with Israel is as a bully state completely in the last 20 years. You know, the notion that it's this victim is just doesn't conform to anything that's happened in the last 20 years, except for October 7th and the atrocities committed by on that particular day. But that's in a different context for these younger folks than it is for most of the older generation.
Tell me about how, I know you were actually on campus. You were a student organizer at the University of Wisconsin. And when you found out, you told me this just now, when you found out about the Kent State murders of students in Ohio, I think although there have not been murders yet, there's certainly no aims to take their safety into account. But this is an incredibly radicalizing moment for students. I guess talk about your experience and also there's a Rubicon we're crossing, and a Rubicon when you're a student, when you realize that your own government does not value your life. Forget about free speech. They don't value your life.
Yeah. I was at the University of Wisconsin. It was primarily white campus where tear gas was used in 1967 after a demonstration against Dow Chemical. The National Guard occupied the campus twice, once in February 1969 when the black students led a strike of blacks and all of us for black studies and admissions, a more equitable admissions policy and teaching of black history. And then the next year after Nixon invaded Cambodia, I was on the library mall where the encampment at the University of Wisconsin was just taken down a couple of days ago by the police. We were having a book sale for our revolutionary collective to sell books when someone came by, said, four students were just killed at Kent State. So those of us selling the books cut the prices in half and started hollering to everybody, get the books at half price. We won't be here tomorrow because the National Guard will be occupying the campus. And we were right. They came the next day. But here's the big difference, I think, besides just the level of, the police were brutal to us. We were beaten. You know, I had guns pointed at us, stuff like that. But the difference today that makes it very, very difficult is that there was no one on the campus who felt they were directly a victim of the protesters. Today, the way the charge of anti-Semitism is being used, there's the allegation that there are students on campus, not just what's happening in Israel-Palestine, but students on campus who are victims, who are threatened, who are not safe because of the protests. So in our day, we got beaten, we got harassed and all that, but it was clearly us versus the administration and the government. We weren't protesting the frat bros who might come around and beat us up in 1965. By 1969, they were also opposed to the war and fighting the police the same as we were. But, you know, there were right wingers on campus, but there was a sociological layer. And today, there is. There's a Jewish students who claim to be, and in some cases, they genuinely feel unsafe. That doesn't mean that it's legitimate or that it that the protests are directed against them. So that there is the wedge here to say not that just those students, the protests are, you know, disruptive to campus life or something like that, but that they're actually a threat to the American Jewish population, the student population who is Jewish. And the administration has, as MAGA people in particular, but unfortunately the Biden administration and quite a number of Democrats, not all, have bought into that notion. And they found that that's an extremely effective tactic and an extremely effective message to put out there. Because they, instead of saying, we don't like the protests because we like what's going on in Israel, we think you shouldn't be protesting what's happening in Gaza, they try to shift the conversation. So there's a genocide going on in Gaza, and the media now is all talking about how unsafe Jewish students are on campus and has picked out one or two incidents here and there where some provocateur or some protester who doesn't have their head screwed on right has made some anti-Semitic remarks. 34,000 dead in Gaza is not as important as one Jewish student who feels uncomfortable because someone said from the river to the sea.
Absolutely. And in some cases, completely bad faith. And, you know, we've seen protests shut down because a heckler, a counter demonstrator said, kill the Jews. And then the pro-Palestinian folks get arrested. The whole thing gets shut down because that's how easy it is, which is wild. I mean, and they're, yes, I think it is for the media and for a lot of politicians who were looking for how to reframe this genocide, this has been a blessing to them. It doesn't mean that the students should pack it in or that this is not a valiant and an important movement. Remember, this movement obviously is about their own, where their own schools are invested, where their tuition money is invested. And I think that the divestment movement that has been going on for so many decades has, just like the BDS movement, has done the groundwork for these students to plug into. So they're not, you know, it is not a movement without demands. It is, I mean, as wonderful as Occupy was, it actually is much more focused than Occupy ever was. But of course, it's being repressed in the exact same way. I have a lot of thoughts, but I just wanted to, you know, you focus a lot on the backlash to the civil rights movement and this multi-decade project by the right to overturn, to roll back the clock. And it feels so sick to me that vis-a-vis false allegations of anti-Semitism on college campuses, the right has their in for a project they've tried to accomplish for many, many years now, which is undermine higher education, which is to undermine any kind of diversity, equity, inclusion programs, affirmative action. You know, they're already rolling on that, of course. And that so-called liberal institutions are basically handing them the playbook and the keys or the match and dousing themselves in lighter fluid, as we talk about Aaron Bushnell, right? Like, but truly allowing the right to dismantle their very institutions and effectively, you know, I mean, you talk about Black students arguing for Black studies. You know, we talk about Asian American students in Berkeley arguing for, you know, ethnic studies or Asian American studies. They are undoing this in one fell swoop. And why? To protect a largely white, but an ethno state in Israel, the ethno state of Israel, that is deeply right wing, either because of who's in leadership, but you could argue based on the actual project of Israel in and of itself.
Well,
there's no question there, Max. It's just my thoughts.
We have to understand the country that we live in. You know, we were brought up, my generation and yours and the next generation, on this. The American story is, you know, yes, we were imperfect at the beginning. There were a few minor problems, but it's been a gradual, like you said at the beginning, learning process, and the country has moved toward a more perfect union. It's been a gradual process, a little few fits and starts, but things are getting better. The American dream is coming closer and closer to more and more people. It's not true. Gains that were made were always made through intense struggles from the bottom up. And when they won things, there was a backlash. And it's mm-hmm. been a struggle between the democratic bottom-up impulse, which is what's been present from the beginning with Native American resistance, slave revolts, those progressive thinkers, the most advanced people, the abolitionist movement, against the powers that be. And at certain junctures, those movements have been powerful enough to make big changes in the country. The Reconstruction period, the Reconstruction amendments. But then there's a backlash. And that pattern got repeated in the 1930s with the New Deal and the backlash against the New Deal. And then it got repeated in the 1960s with the upsurge that the Black-led civil rights movement opened the door for all the movements that we have talked about and treasured and participated in since then, second wave feminism, LGBTQ movement, environmental movement, the movements of all the different peoples of color. And we've been living through the backlash, and that whole story about everything is just progressing and progressing is to cover up what a bitter struggle it is.
Yep.
And those establishment forces. Now, the headquarters of the reaction, it was in the Confederacy, the slaveholding states. There's a direct line from those who defended slavery, to the Jim Crow period, to those who never accepted the New Deal, to those who fought against the civil rights movement. And it's no accident, if you look at the electoral map, that the one-party states in this country are the same one party, the Confederacy, and a few other states, which are authoritarian enclaves. They're implementing basically the same, a 21st century version of the 1836 program, all wealth to the rich, second-class citizenship for people of color, minimize or eliminate the social safety net, militarism, push women back into the home, gender and racial hierarchies.
Yep.
Those forces are leading it. And then, yes, unfortunately, the liberal center of the country doesn't understand what the real history of the country, tries to straddle the fence, is dividing between those. Jerry Nadler, who's pro-Israel and all this, opposes a lot of these things. You know, there's a block in the Democratic Party that has moved to the left, and the base of the Democratic Party is moving largely to the left, and there's others who are moving to the right. And that's the fight, that's one of the key fights we're engaged in. And what's so important about supporting the student uprising, supporting the people who in Congress who've fought for a ceasefire, supporting the squad, and changing the dynamic. You know, but it's always a struggle. You know, there's no free lunch for our team.
Well, let's talk about changing the dynamic. You know, I want to talk about Biden. I want to talk about obviously the threat of Trump. But I think what a lot of people are seeing is that, there's not a lot of daylight between what Trump would have done in this situation with genocide on the people of Gaza and what Biden is doing. And it was interesting because yesterday during a press conference, Biden said, obviously throwing the students under the bus and whatnot, calling them violent, even though it's the cops who are violent. But he said, he was asked, will this make you change your policy? And he said, no. But then as he walked away, key moment, Max, he was asked, will you call in the National Guard? No, he said, as he walked away. Now, you referenced Nixon calling in the National Guard. Should we be thankful the National Guard isn't being called in? Is that the current ring of hell that we are in this so-called lesser of two evils?
No, we shouldn't be thankful. I mean, that's the no. What we should be is hard-nosed. And what we should say to ourselves is what we have to make a measurement of, is there daylight between the Republicans and the Democrats? And on this, we have to get out of the horse race. It's not about Trump and about it's about the social forces that are behind MAGA and the social forces that are opposed to MAGA. And the social forces behind MAGA is united around a detailed agenda that's out there in Project 2025, the Heritage Foundation, to dismantle the protections that remain for whatever democratic space we have left and whatever economic and social rights have been won by workers, peoples of color, women, LGBT folks, and so on. Right. The social bloc opposed to MAGA is divided itself into different factions. There's a progressive faction, more or less led by Bernie Sanders, the Squad, Sean Fain from the UAW, you know, the students, that block. And within that block, we've made a lot of headway compared to where we were 5 years ago. And the only the question in the election is, who would we rather fight? I'm blanking on
Donald Trump right now.
Wrote an enemy wrote a piece. Why I'm voting for the enemy in the Nation. What conditions would be better? Is it better for MAGA and, like you said before, U.S. style fascism running, or this vacillating top level of the Democratic Party, which is the ground under them? I mean, Netanyahu's prolonging the war because he wants Trump to win, and then a green light and complete annexation. It's no good for the Palestinians. And the Republicans would take down every organization that has come out for a ceasefire would be weaker under a Trump administration, weakened. But the labor, the resurgents in the labor movement would be undermined. Groups that are explicitly Palestine solidarity groups will be illegal.
Yes, you know. It will be America will be Florida. I mean, what I love that you about what you just said is, well, I don't really like it because I don't believe, and I've said this, I don't believe Biden deserves to win this election. I just don't. Obviously, I don't believe Trump deserves to, but Biden sure as shit doesn't deserve to win this election. He didn't deserve to win in 2020, doesn't deserve to win now, but we deserve to win. Whatever scraps of democracy we have deserves to win. It is a very challenging time because when ostensibly an election, a grassroots election campaign the people who mobilized in 2020, some of these, again, like base building, you know, local organizations, POC led, in swing states, who would otherwise be mobilizing, are absolutely paralyzed in some ways by Biden's reaction or Biden's throwing down with genocide, again, with a man who, as you just said, would absolutely like to continue. Biden is helping Netanyahu continue this war until November so that Trump can win. Like, it is wild to me how much this man is playing into his own defeat. He is such a capital L loser in every fucking sense of the word, Max. It drives me up the wall. But again, we don't deserve to be the losers in this. And again, we talked about it. John Kerry was running against George W. Bush. John Kerry was running, trying to run to the right of Bush. I mean, of all things. Oh, I'm going to get the terrorists deader than dead. Al-Qaeda doesn't stand a chance. Yada, yada, yada. The first black president got Osama bin Laden. He got nothing for it. But anyway, but at the time, you know, there was a lot of us who were saying, you know, as you always lay out, you know, like the idea of like, let's teach them a lesson by not voting. You know, let's teach them a lesson by voting third party. And they never fucking learn their lesson, do they? They never, it doesn't actually work that way in a two-party system here that we've got. Sorry, I have a lot of scrambled thoughts here, but I do want to name just how weak I think this re-election campaign is. And how dangerous it is, and how easy it is for, I think, liberals who read the New York Times every day, very, very, who play their Wordle, no disrespect, how easy it is for them to finger wag at the students as if these are the students, these are the young people who will cost Biden the election, when it is so clear that Joe Biden doesn't give a shit about their vote, doesn't care about their vote, and is specifically throwing down. I've said this before, I get 2016 vibes. We don't need you to win. Thank you. We would rather get the suburban former Republican female vote to come over to our side.
Yeah.
I said a lot of things there, but yeah.
They're all true. But, you know, here's the problem. And there's no, look, we are paying the price for how politics is viewed in this country and our failure over the last many, many decades for the left to be strong enough to convince people that politics is about social classes, political interests. It's not a spectacle. It's not about candidates. It's about a direction and how much power a certain social force exerts. That's what it's about. And we have to be hard-nosed in that calculation. It is absolutely true that the majority of voters, the majority of people out there, don't look at politics that way. And that's the reality we live in. It's absolutely wrong for us for the left to be cluck-clucking and self-righteous toward people who don't see things the way we do at this point. We should look to ourselves and the difficulty we building that consciousness. We recognize we're up against a very entrenched, well-financed, powerful establishment that's used to ruling the world. So, of course, we're going to have a hard time, but we need to do better. So no, I'm not going
to
lecture anybody who, you know, their vote, they feel morally, how can you vote for someone who's been doing this? You know, if that's the terms of the discussion, I'll argue that it's politically better, but I'm not going to go to the mat with somebody. But those who are trying to deal with the hard-nosed realities of what are we going to face on January 21st, 2025? And are we going to be sitting there waiting for the IRS to come and shut you down, for the Justice Department to go after its enemy, for Rashida Tlaib not just to be censured, but to be charged with treason and arrested? Or are we better off having the squad and 30 or 40 other progressives, be part of the majority party, have some influence? Do we want to see the NLRB transformed in a way that would blunt the energy in the labor movement right now? Or do we want to see that momentum continue so that maybe in 2 or 3 or 4 years, we'd be a major player and we wouldn't be as dependent on individuals like Jesse Jackson when he ran for president, or Bernie when he ran in 2016, 2020, we'd have sufficient infrastructure to actually play in the mainstream politics.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, the big difference between, I mean, I assume between the 60s and, you know, definitely when I was coming up in the early 2000s is that we didn't have a squad, you know. Part of me, you know, I keep on, you know, as because I do this, I guess, for a living, I do it for a living, patreon.com.
You deserve a better living than you get. Everybody listening should be contributing.
God damn it.
Money.
Exactly. Like my good friend Electron Creations over here says, this is one of the many reasons why you are the only one I choose to support with my meager scraps. Keep up the good work, Franny. Thank you, Cindy. And patreon.com/bituationroom. But is that part of me is like, okay, so I know a lot of politicians' names, but when I was protesting the war in 2003, I didn't know a single one. I remember when I was in D.C., I mean, I knew who Dennis Kucinich was because he was against the war. I was in D.C. and some like right-wing outlet came up to me and showed me pictures of like different Congress people and was like, who is this? And I was like, I don't fucking know. We're trying to stop a war. Like, I don't know. Is he against the war? Probably not. And they were sort of like, it was a funny moment because they were trying to gotcha on these stupid protesters if you think that. But so part of me is like, am I just older that I know more politicians' names and I have to do this for a living? And yes, a little bit, but also they've given us a reason to pay attention to who they are, right? They're speaking to the people, they're from the people. There are a lot of these squad members are mostly people of color. They are, I mean, all pretty much all under the age of 50, which is actually pretty young when it comes to Congress. And they, you know, they have things like Medicare for All, actually, you know, addressing climate justice. They have more fire in them, almost the way that some Republicans have fire for when it comes to, you know, like whatever, instituting only two genders and things like this. So we are in a very different place, even though it feels like the song remains the same. We do have more of a foot in our inside-outside strategy. And I don't give a shit whether people think that AOC visiting the Columbia protests was performative. We need performance. If only. You don't think that Joe Biden going to a picket line outside of UAW was performative? Absolutely performative. And important. A very important performance it was. So I guess the problem is, Max, and I'm very curious about what you think beyond the election. When it comes to Middle East policy, it feels like there's no going back here. It feels like we have a generational psychic break. Obviously, there's a break between American Jews and Israeli Jews. American Jews being very progressive and being against the actions of Netanyahu and the right-wing government, being more willing to talk about occupation, being even more willing to say anti-Zionist as prickly as a phrase that can be. But I am curious what you think, because, you know, whether or not we like want to take what he said as face value, but it's very, you know, the United States was attacked on 9/11 in part because of our policy around Israel, right? Like, this is what, the second, third, fourth war that thanks to our policies around Israel, I meant bin Laden, obviously. Like, where do we go from here more broadly? Let's say Biden is reelected. Let's say we do get a second shot at this. Where do we push? And is there, you know, when it comes to the Middle East, I think more broadly?
Look, we're in a lot of trouble. We're in deep shit.
Okay.
You said it before, and you're right, that the center is collapsing. The center is having what has been liberal democratic capitalism in United States and some Western European and a few in the world, is having a very hard time restabilizing itself as the leading force in a system that isn't way, way more dependent on repression and misery than it has been. And it's already had plenty. It's already had plenty, but more. So there's a question about what direction is going to, what's going to replace that and how fast. Right now, the right, the far right, is in the best position to replace that with a more nakedly fascist state. They've concluded, they think demographics are against them, making any concessions to feminism, to black rights, opens the door to serious big problems. They really do think Biden, for all of this that was said, they think Biden is a stalking horse for a kind of country that they don't want to, they think will eliminate white Christian America as they have known it. And they want power and they want to get it and they want to run the country for a few generations, and they have a detailed plan and an infrastructure and they're ready to use it. The left, starting about 2016, with of course many, many years of experience and struggle behind it, but in 2016 with Bernie's campaign in the latest round, has figured out how you have to become a force that plays in mainstream politics.
Yes.
You have to juggle grassroots movements. You have to work in the electoral arena. You have to rebuild mass organizations, especially the labor movement. You need a message. You need a narrative. You need an agenda. Like you said, women's health bill, John Lewis Voting Rights Act, PRO Act, Green New Deal, Medicare for All. You need a program and an agenda, and you need an infrastructure. And like you said, it includes needing performative things as well as grassroots day-to-day organizing. We need some more years to build up that infrastructure in order to change politics. And foreign policy is always the hardest nut to crack. Foreign policy is always held most closely, most removed from democratic input. Even Congress can't hold the executive branch accountable in the way that it can on many, most domestic issues. It's the most shielded from popular participation.
I mean, yes, just a quick sidebar. Part of Project 2025 is like, oh, they won't even consult Congress when they want to send weapons and go to war. And it's like, that's literally what we're already doing. Next chapter, because that's already in place now.
But the imperial presidency, I mean, all of that. But we need some time to get that level of power. But absolutely, our main goal strategically long-term is building up that power. It's not electing Democrats. The main goal is building up that power for those forces in society that have a consistent progressive agenda, and fleshing out, making sure that agenda isn't corrupted by progressive except Palestine or any other important issue with it that represents a marginalized, vulnerable people. We include rights for all and a better society for all. We need the time to build that up. And we can't get it under a Trump administration. So we're stuck. This is why we have to unite with anti-Trump generals, with Joe Biden, with anyone who's against Trumpism for any reason, to buy ourselves enough time to build up that power and then let go by it. What you said is
right. But it's funny because, yeah, go ahead.
We have the squad is new. That's different from where you were in 2004. The other thing that's new was the Republican Party wasn't yet a fascist party like it is now. Project 2025 was not George Bush's agenda. Compassionate conservatism was George Bush's agenda. It wasn't great. It was reactionary. It was a step in the wrong direction, but wasn't a thoroughgoing fascist program, which is what we're facing today. And not just the program. They've got everybody lined up of who's going to be the chief of staff, who's going to be the secretary of state, who's going to be the secretary of defense. They're going to put Steven Miller in charge of rounding up 10 million people and deporting them. I mean, so we've got to buy that time. And it's not because it's our preference. It's not because Joe Biden deserves anything but ideological contempt for what he's doing and moral approbation for what he's doing in Gaza. But we're stuck with this. This is the reality of American politics.
If
we want an easier road,
we move to Spain.
Business. It's just unfortunate. It's not fair.
Yeah, no, and the problem I find is we have to be in this coalition with literal war criminals who do not want to be in coalition with us. If they want to be in coalition with us, they want us to shut up and get along to go along, right? Or go along to get along, whatever the phrase is. And that coalition, the stewards of this model whereby you get to be in a coalition but shut the fuck up, are everyday liberals, you know, are like, you know, people who I love, like my mom, you know what I mean? Like, you know, people who, like, somebody I got into a really long conversation with who's like a celebrity whose name I will not drop to you, but like, who's just like, if only these students would shut up, you know, and it's purely transactional. It's purely transactional and it's so messed up. And so, again, I think a lot of these students would love to be, once again, not love to be, will be in coalition with Biden if Biden showed a glimmer of wanting to be in coalition with them, that he at all wanted their vote. Yes, there's been student debt relief, but give even a performative, I see you, I hear you. But this is a dude who's never been, you think this dude's ever stuck his neck out for a cause ever that didn't benefit him? I mean, just personally, like, yes, he said it's like, these are the people who can only identify with something that's happened to them. I don't think Biden's ever gone to a protest that wasn't a transactional, this will help me in the election. He doesn't understand. You don't empathize with these kids because you never actually stuck your neck out for a cause that wasn't, you know, fundraising for your own reelection.
Yeah, but here's the problem with that. You're absolutely right about the students, but here's the difficulty. Biden does see and want the votes of reproductive rights activists. Biden does see and want the votes of union members.
Sure.
He goes to those places. He sees them. They're part of that coalition. Many people in the reproductive rights movement and even more in the labor movement now have come out against his policies around Gaza. And Sean Fain and the UAW issued a statement about opposing the arrests of the students. They're not just a passive comment about ceasefire, but don't go after the students.
That's right.
And they're playing the influence that they have in that. So one point is we want that kind of group to grow in influence. We don't want that kind of group to fall in influence.
Of course.
The second thing is, that's true about Biden and many others in the Democratic Party, but it's changing at different levels.
Yes.
There are layers within, and there's a middle layer within the Democratic Party. There are senators who are talking about conditioning aid to Israel. Now, the thing is, we want, of course, from our point of view, it's happening too slowly. People are dragging their feet. They're conciliating the right. But the motion is largely in our direction on this.
Yeah.
And how do we keep that motion going? Do we go off into our stronghold and just talk about Genocide Joe all the time? Or do we stay in there, keep over and over again until we change their minds? I mean, this is one lesson I learned in the anti-Vietnam War movement. The same people who were screaming at us if we were protesting in 1966 in 1971 were on our side. And the more
that is incredible. I mean, that to me is incredible. I mean, like, sorry, keep going.
You want to do something to build an on-ramp so they can come onto your team.
Yes.
And not make them feel, oh, you're morally impure, because I don't remember exactly when my first anti-war demonstration, I think I was 1966, my first teach-in or something, or it was 1965. Does that mean that if in 1964 somebody said, oh, you're a sellout, you don't support the thing, I didn't become anti-Zionist until 1968 or 1969? But that was partly because people who were already in that place wanted to bring me into these movements. They mentored me. They taught me. They didn't say, oh, you know, when I put up a little tussle on something, they would say, oh, you're so backward. You know, you're not pure enough.
This is true. But were those people literally looking at children being blown apart and going, yeah, but Hamas? Like, I hear you, Max. I do think that, like I said, never before have we seen the issue of Palestinian liberation so mainstreamed. And there are many on-ramps. I think that these student protesters are actually incredibly approachable. And, you know, I just visited Occidental yesterday, and it was so lovely, you know, and the community support was there, and I just get chills all over again. And so, I mean, on the political level, I agree with you, and it is it's nice to be reminded of how hard it is to change foreign policy. But also, I think on this issue, the BDS movement has been turbocharged. Divestment is, again, the D in BDS. And especially as you're talking about the conditioning of aid and the idea that as Americans, we withhold, we don't have to talk about, you don't have to talk about if you don't want two state, one state, red state, blue state, to take away the money from this genocidal state. There we go. That's my poem. But I appreciate the hell out of you as always, Max. And I said this was going to be a 30-minute conversation. Of course, it was an hour-long conversation. Just hit the hour-long mark. It's a tough time. I'm glad it's not October right now. I do still think there is, I don't know what there is, but there is time before the election. But also Palestinians on the ground, sadly, don't have time, right? So we have to keep on with the pressure. And there's a lot of little Max albums being created out there on these campuses. So what's it like to have a life of being a radical? Is it worth it?
Well, everybody, it was worth it. It is worth it for me. Everybody has to, the world's a very, very complicated place, and everybody has to figure out for themselves the balance in their life between things they're interested in, taking care of their family, giving something back to the world. Everybody's going to have a little different view about that. There's no homogenizing that about there's only one thing that is right about how your life should be. Different people respond differently. Not everyone's going to be a political activist. We can hope for a world where everybody has good values, but that's not going to translate into everybody being a political activist. People have to live with themselves about what they do when they see other human beings suffering. And I think most people don't want to see other people suffer and will try to do something about it.
Yeah.
And the left has to find that part of every person we can who feels that way and work with it, so that they understand the reasons why people are suffering in terms of social injustice and the nature of the systems, and find an action for them to participate in that matches the level that they're willing to participate.
Yeah.
And it's very, very hard to accept the fact that it takes longer than it should.
Yes, I mean, it is very hard to accept.
This war in Gaza should have ended 80 years ago. I mean, you're talking about, Rashid Khalidi has a book, The 100-Year War on Palestine. There are so many junctures at which what's happening today should have gone a different way.
Yeah.
From the victory of Zionism within the Jewish community when Zionism was a minority position until the Holocaust, to the how the vote came down around petition in the UN, to what happened at, when Israel initially to get into the UN had to agree to the right of return and then didn't practice it. The settlement. There's so many.
I didn't remember that piece of history.
It should have ended. October 7th should have been, after 9/11. You and I talked about this back then. In a fantasy world of the left, the president of the United States would have stood up and said, "What happened on 9/11 shows that this world is out of kilter. The world is out of joint. The times are out of joint, if you want to use Shakespeare. And I'm calling an international conference to figure out how to solve the problems of inequality, injustice, discrimination, and environment. And we'll deal with people who are using terrorism and killing innocent people through a legal system, and we'll start a new direction for the world." That was the lesson that could have been drawn. It was drawn by thinkers like Einstein and Martin Luther King. When the nuclear war bomb went off, Einstein says, "Everything's changed except our thinking." And we're way behind. We're way behind as a species in figuring out how to deal with this. We have to do it through struggle, through political struggle, through class struggle.
I'm getting emotional I'm getting emotional because I these moments of extreme violence brings you back to where, like, I'm sure it brings you back to where you were in Vietnam, brings me back to where I was on 9/11. I was in Manhattan, brings me back to these extreme images of violence that we see that never in my wildest, if you put me in power, in my wildest imagination, of course, in order to get there, I would have to sell my soul in a million different pieces. So who knows who I would be? Would I say, the answer is, let's do more killing. Hey, that killing, let's do more. And so it that feeling that, the night that on March 19th, 2003, when we invaded Iraq, the day that we saw those images from Abu Ghraib, the day that, the My Lai massacre news broke. I mean, these things are just, they scar you. And the imagining that you could see the violence of October 7th and the violence that has been happening up until October 7th on the Palestinian people, and of course, in reaction to the occupation, and think you need more death and destruction. I mean, it's like a part of you just, I have a part of me that is just in total disbelief. And I get emotional because I think what you're saying, yeah, man, there are so many other avenues to pursue. They are wide open. There is a buffet of options that have nothing to do with militarism. But who's making money on those? I mean, ew, gross. So, but anyway, I love you so much and thank you for being here and thank you everyone for listening and watching. Max, tell us about Convergence Magazine. Does some incredible movement writing and also has a podcast.
Well, we've gone for a long time. Yes, we have writing. We have podcasts. The podcast is called Block and Build. It's hosted by our director, Caden Mack. Go to www.convergencemag.com and you can find all of that. It's a
great
publication of Radical Insights. It was a lovely day that you and I met. I'm very thankful for that day back in 2003.
Yes.
You know, and here we are 20 some years later. And we're just keeping up the dialogue we started the first time we met.
Indeed, we are. Thank you so much, Max. Take very good care. And thank you all for being here. Love Max. And I'll put his latest article in the description. I'll put links to Convergence Mag. But Max is, again, the Nostradamus of the left. Why am I blanking on his name? It's because I don't really know it. But, like, you know, the Lord of the Rings guy. Lord of Rings guy. I am everyone's worst girlfriend. The magician. The dude, you know. The guy. The dude. Yes, thank you, Owen the Schmoopy Dragon. Gandalf, I was waiting for that. Yes. None shall pass his incredible analysis. You've all been great. Super love you. Some super chats. I don't have a lot of super chats. Send in a super chat. Send in something. Send in some love. Tip the show. TBR-Live on Venmo. TBR Live on Cash App. Become a patron to get ad-free content. Guys, this is, if you like this, you'd love Wednesdays. Wednesdays are only available to members on YouTube and Twitch and patrons. So get at that. And I just will leave you all with a comment from member Christo Stefan, who says, I always leave these for Antifa meetings burning inside. I hope that fire is a good fire, and I hope it's a fire of action and resilience. Lots of love to you all. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend. Take care. Bye-bye.